Whether you're looking for answers to specific life questions or seeking to become the best version of you possible, welcome to the Mental Breakdown and Psych Reg podcast, where we offer insight, information, and strategies based upon research and years of practice as clinical psychologists. So sit back, have a listen, and get connected with our hosts, Dr. Bernie Wilkinson and Dr. Richard Marshall. Welcome back. Richard, today we're going to talk about something that we have discussed before, but
it needs it again.
And we're going to talk about it in a little bit more detail today.
Right.
First off, I'm going to mention that we're sitting a little bit different than we usually do, and it's from some suggestions that we have received from viewers.
And we request viewers to call in, make whatever recommendations, suggestions, comments that they want to make.
Yeah, and so it feels a little odd because we're sitting a little bit like we're facing each other a little bit more.
You'll get used to this. I do it every time. So you get used to it.
Yeah, I'll get used to it.
Plus, it's your good side.
Okay.
I don't have a good side, but you have a good side, so.
I don't know.
It'll be nicer.
I don't know about good sides or anything like that, but it's just we'll have to see how it goes. Because we'll be looking at each other a little bit more than usual. Usually we look at the camera, and
that's hard. It's hard to look at you and keep a straight
face.
It is.
It's like, I just want to...
There's so many things we could say. But we will contain ourselves.
But
actually, we will inhibit, which is appropriate
for this
topic. I
was just
going
to say, we have to control our impulses a little bit as we're talking about this, while we're talking about ADHD.
We are going to control our impulses while we talk about a disorder of impulse control.
That's right. That's right. So we're going to talk a little bit about ADHD today and really kind of delve into why there are such significant differences across geographic regions in the prevalence and treatment of ADHD.
That's right. What prompted this, and we've talked about this study before, haven't
in
other podcasts. What prompted this discussion this morning is the study out of a whole book that mentions this, that children in the rates of ADHD in France are much lower than they are in the United States,
right.
Number one, and that far fewer children are medicated for ADHD, even if they receive the diagnosis.
Right.
Far fewer are medicated in France than in the U.S.
Right.
And this whole issue was the result of a book written by Dr. Marilyn Wedge. The title of it was A Disease Called Childhood. You know, catchy title, right? Mm-hmm. A Disease Called Childhood, Why ADHD Became an American Epidemic. And so she wrote this book. The title is self-explanatory, but she mentions ADHD in French children.
Right.
And that's what, there's been a flurry of activity, both for and against what she had to say in that book. So we want to talk about this morning because there's really a lot of useful information in these discussions that we wanted to share with listeners.
Yeah. So let's sort of begin with some of that information. So we know that there are considerable differences in the rates of diagnosing ADHD in different places.
Right.
As you said, in France and in other countries,
there are
relatively few children diagnosed and subsequently medicated for ADHD.
Yeah, certainly far fewer than in the United States.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, in the United States, I think that the current prevalency hovers right around, overall, and we'll get to some of why we're saying it that way in just a moment, but overall, I think that the rate lies somewhere around 11%, 10 to 11% of children.
But over time, it's been rising, and that's one of the other concerns. Are we going to talk about that?
We are.
Not now.
In a moment.
I will contain myself.
Please.
No, but the rates in the United States are about 11%.
Right.
And in France, they're hovering around 3%.
Right.
Yeah. And so there's a huge, it's a factor of three.
Right.
Or four, almost a factor of four.
Right. And if ADHD is a disorder, a neurological disorder, as we know that it is, why would there be such a significant difference between children who grow up in France and those who grow up in the United States?
Right.
And that's difficult to explain, simply thinking about it from a biological perspective.
That's right. We both subscribe to the theory that this is a brain-based disorder.
Correct.
Okay.
Right.
There's the little argument about that. But the interesting, and there is an argument that it's really not a neurological disorder.
Right.
Okay. But we believe it is, and we'll talk about that some mm-hmm. as we get into this. The issue at hand, the issue that we want to discuss first is, if it's a neurological disorder, the prevalence rate should be similar
right.
across countries.
Right.
Okay. If it's not, then there's some environmental factor.
Right.
It's like heart disease.
Yeah.
An article came out this week about the lowest rates of heart disease in the world is some primitive culture
mm-hmm.
in some jungle. I don't know. I forget where it was. But it was some primitive culture. They have essentially no heart disease.
Mm-hmm,
now,
mm-hmm.
life expectancy might be 35
right.
or 40, but yeah. but there are cultural factors. We know that there's less heart disease in China and Japan than there is
right.
in Western Europe and,
right.
and America. So there are cultural differences, and that's really what this article is really about,
mm-hmm.
is it's a neurological disorder, then why the differences in prevalence rates.
Right, right. So you know, I think that just thinking about those two, the United States versus France, is a great mm-hmm. illustration. And we don't even
right.
you don't even have to go to some of the other countries, because in other countries there are those that are similar to our prevalency
right.
rate, and then there are those who are more similar to mm-hmm. France's prevalency rate.
Mm-hmm.
But the difference of 11% versus 3% is considerable. I mean,
right.
that's a massive difference.
Yeah, it's a huge difference in epidemiology. Epidemiologically,
right.
that's a massive difference.
Right.
I mean, you have to look for an explanation. You can't say this is by chance or it's no. These are important. There are important reasons why there would be this magnitude of difference.
Right. Right. So when we think about those differences, there has to be, and as you were alluding, if from an epidemiological perspective,
mm-hmm.
from a neuropsychological perspective,
right.
such a difference can't be explained, then there has to be some other
right.
reason
right.
for this massive difference.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what we tend to look towards, if it's not a biological
right.
reason, then perhaps it's a cultural reason.
Has to be something cultural or environmental or mm-hmm. some other contributing factor.
Right.
Yep.
And so when we think about culture, of course, we have to think about it very broadly. We're not just talking about, you know, the French culture generically.
Right.
Because, again, as we get to some stuff here in the United States, you can't think about the American culture,
mm-hmm.
Whatever
mm-hmm.
that may be.
Whatever it is, yeah.
So we have to think more specifically. So we may be talking about the way that we approach education, the mm-hmm. way that we approach parenting, the way that we approach sort of that the community-based efforts mm-hmm. to raise children and to keep safe and,
yeah.
and healthy environments and those kinds of issues
right.
as well.
Yeah, it's about child rearing.
And food.
Right.
You know?
Child rearing practices and
right.
sleep and nutrition and feeding and
mm-hmm.
Discipline procedures and schooling and
right.
all those things that would come under the broad heading of child rearing.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
Right.
We spoke a couple weeks ago, I think, a week or two ago, about an effort that was taken in a Texas school,
yes,
where
right.
they increased recess,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and what they found was a significant reduction
right.
in ADHD symptoms and ADHD diagnoses. And so that's an example of how a original sort of cultural
right.
Decision
mm-hmm.
changes the prevalency rate of ADHD.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Now, as we're going through this, I think we have to really make sure that we differentiate ADHD. Real ADHD from a diagnosis of ADHD.
That's one of the essential points here.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, we have to differentiate those things because, as many of you who are listening know, there are a lot of kids that have been diagnosed with a lot of adults who have been diagnosed with ADHD who don't have ADHD.
Right. Right.
And so just having a diagnosis, you know, we often think that, oh, well, that if the diagnosis is there, then that must mean that the disorder is there. And it's just not the case.
That's right. Because the manual that we use,
right.
Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, is a collection of symptoms.
Right.
These are behavioral descriptions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They're not laboratory
mm-hmm.
diagnoses.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. that all of the disorders in the manual are behavioral descriptions.
Right.
Okay. So you may have the behaviors, but not the disorder.
Right.
And we make that very clear distinction.
Right.
Yeah, you can have the symptoms.
Right.
You can have the characteristics, but you don't have the disorder.
Right. And this is, it, for any of you who have ever taught, where you had to either teach children or even adults, you can create an environment of ADHD simply by the way that you teach.
That's right.
So if you're teaching material that is far beyond or far below the class's competence, then you're going to quickly see that they're going to fall off task, they're going to be distracted, they'll become fidgety, they'll get up and move around and do all those kinds of things.
All the things that ADHD kids with ADHD do.
Right. Right. But then if you take those same students and you teach at their level, where they're competent, you're going to see those rates of behavior significantly drop.
That's right. Teach them at their level. Teach them something they're interested in, that they need, that they want to know about, that they need to know about, and they'll be fine. The symptoms will disappear.
Absolutely.
Right. But it's, the other example we can use is alcohol. A lot of people, you know, you can drink, you can have all the carry, but you don't have... You wouldn't be considered substance abusing just because you have a drink.
Right.
Okay. So you have the symptom, but you don't have the disorder.
Right. So we have these differences. And then so one of our points today, one of the things that we really wanted to emphasize today is some explanations for why we see such significant differences in based upon, again, we're going to use the word culture as opposed to simply geographical regions or anything.
Yeah, because
like that.
They're really more cultural, the way we do things in a particular culture, how we school, the school practices, the parent rearing practices, how we deal with the first 12 months of life, bonding and attachment and all that. All these, they're really child rearing practices that are cultural more than geographic.
Right.
Although there are massive geographic differences.
Right.
We took a tour years ago through Cajun country. And we didn't go to New Orleans, we went to the Cajun area, the countryside. And it's a vastly different culture.
Right.
Different language, different child rearing, different schooling, different expectations. Vastly different culture in that geographic location.
Right. So let's just start with some of those. And the first one, of course, that's probably the most, the biggest elephant in the room, and that's education.
Right.
Most kids are referred for a diagnosis or referred because of concerns with ADHD by their teacher.
That's right. This really becomes a problem for most children when they get to school age. That's when these characteristics... Most parents are able to tolerate these characteristics in a home setting.
Right.
Okay. And because there are no... There's so few expectations, as long as the child is eating and sleeping and not setting the house on fire, it's tolerable. When the child gets to school, there's a different set of expectations. And when they can't meet those expectations is when problems begin and when the possibility of a diagnosis is first raised.
Right. So we tend to see that, I think you're kicking the camera.
I think you touched my leg. Maybe that's why I jumped.
So if you're watching this on YouTube, you just saw the camera like...
Didn't they?
Yes. You know, I can't take this.
That's probably because you were banging the table or something.
It's not on the table. All right. See, that's how distractions happen. That's how it happens right there, folks. So back to task. We got to get back on task. So
there's a point here that we're going to make later about parenting and setting boundaries. So I just had some boundaries set, parental boundaries set on where my feet are allowed to go.
You know, so. I'm gonna put tape on the floor, and you're not allowed to leave that area.
Okay. That's right. You could do a little thing of duct tape around me, and I can't exceed the boundaries of the duct tape.
Man, yeah. So it made me nervous there. I was like, we're having an earthquake or something. So, what were we talking about? Oh, I know what we were talking about.
About parenting, culture, schooling.
We were talking about schooling. Right. And so, so you're absolutely right. It's around that time in school that we start to see the presence of these symptoms emerge.
Yeah,
because at home, you know, none of us, or very few of us really, expect our kids to sit down for any length of time while we're just talking to them. You know, we when we have to do those kinds of things, we generally restrict it to just a couple of minutes at the most.
Right.
But then when they go to school, you know, they're expected to do so for a long period of time.
Right.
And so those kids with authentic ADHD, they're just not able to do that. And so we start to see those symptoms.
That's right. At home, and we mentioned this in our book, How to Raise an Emotionally Healthy Child, that at home, you don't have a strict... Kids, if they feel like painting, they paint. And when they're done, they go on to something else. If they're hungry, they eat. If they're not hungry, you don't have those. But in school, you have to have these scheduled activities.
Mm-hmm.
And if kids can't adjust to the schedule, then they start to fall outside the normal range. And so it's a complete, you know, some kids just can't adjust to that. This is quiet time. This is nap time. This is, we're going to do math now. And kids aren't, many kids are not used to working on that kind of a schedule.
So we see, that's why we see authentic ADHD emerge during this time. Now, what has happened, and we've talked about this a lot on both this podcast and our other podcast that we don't really do much of anymore, but is still posted, the Paideia Education Podcast, is that the way that the education system, especially here in the United States, has changed over the past few decades, we have seen a correlated increase in the prevalence of ADHD. And what we know and what we have seen is that the changes that we have made in the education system have created conditions in the classroom that make it much more difficult for children, even typically developing children, to meet the expectations.
That's right. A typically a normally developing five-year-old boy is simply, many of them are simply not capable of meeting the higher expectation that now exists in kindergarten and first grade. It's not the, all that has changed is we've moved the curriculum down. What we used to do in first grade, we now do in kindergarten. We've said this many times. There are many five-year-olds who aren't prepared to do that kind of academic work. Doesn't make them abnormal.
It doesn't give.
But if that's the expectation and you're not meeting that expectation, then you come to the attention of administrators and clinicians and physicians and other specialists.
So even if you're completely developmentally appropriate, you're going to, flags are going to go up. And so we have seen over the past couple of decades, an increase in children referred for diagnostic evaluations of ADHD. They just don't have it. They just don't meet criteria. Because when we do the evaluations, we're comparing them to lots and lots of other kids their age, and what we find is that they're very consistent with most kids their age. And so we have this discrepancy between the expectations and the ability to meet those expectations. And this is kind of goes back to what I was saying a moment ago, that if you've been a teacher before, you know that you can create a scenario in your classroom that can foster or elicit ADHD symptoms from your students. Doesn't mean that they have ADHD. It just means that you have created an environment that that contributes to the presentation of ADHD symptoms.
And you could create that environment in any classroom. You could create it in a graduate school classroom. You could create it in a high school classroom. So it's that expectation that changes. And there's... We talked about moving the curriculum from first grade to kindergarten. There's another issue that came up a few years ago that has been addressed in some books, and that is that it's called consequential accountability. When No Child Left Behind was signed into law in 2003, the rates of ADHD took another jump. Because consequential accountability is when students were being held accountable for that higher standard, the standard changed. The rates of ADHD went up. So that's the kind of cultural schooling, school-based difference that we're talking about.
Yeah, because the child's ability, a typical kid's ability remains relatively consistent.
Right.
You know, a student at a particular age, that ability is at a particular level. Whatever we do to the expectations,
that's right,
the child's ability stays the same.
Right.
And
right.
So the expectations change. And so, you know, if they're the same, mm-hmm. that's great. They can meet those expectations.
Right.
But as we continue to increase the expectations, fewer and fewer children are going to mm-hmm. be capable of meeting those expectations.
Right.
And so we're going to increase the number of diagnoses that we make, because we're going to say, well, this is what is expected, so this is what they should be able to do.
That's right.
Because they can't, there must be something wrong with them.
That's right. Because we always, in education, always talked about a developmentally appropriate mm-hmm. curriculum.
Right.
What is developmentally appropriate for a 5-year-old? What's
right.
developmentally appropriate for a 9-year-old? If we continue, if we change that, now what we have in our schools is we have state legislators,
mm-hmm.
not professional educators,
right.
who are saying, this is what children should be able mm-hmm. to do at the end of mm-hmm. kindergarten. That's an artificially...
Right.
That's an artificially based curriculum.
Right.
Not developmentally appropriate,
right.
but it's an artificial curriculum. Somebody
right.
arbitrarily decided that a kindergarten student should be able to write a 4-sentence paragraph.
Right.
That's not developmentally appropriate
right.
for most 5-year-olds. For
right.
some, it's okay.
Yeah.
Some can do it. But it's not developmentally appropriate for most 5-year-olds, especially for our boys.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's an artificially based, it's a curriculum based on artificial or arbitrary standards.
Right.
When we moved it down.
Yeah.
So one of the problems is this consequential accountability. When you
right.
give these high stakes tests, you start pushing children,
right.
you change the expectation, and you create these kinds of issues
right,
for them.
Right. So that's one reason why we see such a dramatic increase in the diagnosis of ADHD here in the United States as compared to other countries, including France. And it's not that France doesn't have high expectations for their students and doesn't necessarily have a rigorous educational philosophy. It's because that they model their system differently.
That's right.
And so the expectations placed on the children are different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people are often surprised, especially people with children who are maybe already in high school or haven't yet started school. They're surprised when they hear here in the United States that there's a lot of schools where kindergartners are expected to do book reports.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's relatively rare.
In
other countries.
In other countries, right.
Other countries
mm-hmm.
don't really have those kinds of expectations.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so those differences alone mm-hmm. are going to account for some of the major variabilities between different countries.
Yeah, I think these expectations, as they've been drafted by state departments of education mm-hmm. and especially state legislators, they make these laws as though, well, if we force them to do it, they'll rise to that level.
Right.
It doesn't work that way in child development and education.
Right. Yeah.
You can set the standard wherever you want.
Right.
That doesn't mean that children are going to achieve it just because you set the standard there.
Right, exactly. It's sort of like, I heard the wonderful analogy, right? I think it's an analogy as opposed to it's an analogy. It's like, you know, you can jump over a bar set
sure.
at 3 foot,
mm-hmm.
but if I say, okay, I really want to push you, so I set it at 5 feet, if you can't jump it at 5 feet, if I raise it to 7 feet, there's just you're still not going to be able to do that.
Yeah, I think it's a good analogy. I think that's a perfect way to describe it. Is
right.
that just because you set the bar higher doesn't mean that people are going to be able to jump over it.
Right.
But that's the assumption
right.
made by legislators. Well, if we make this tough enough, everybody, you know, these teachers will finally be able to push kids to that. No, it doesn't work that way.
Right.
Okay. That's what we've learned over the past 13 years.
Right, right. And what... I think that what has contributed to that is the fact that some kids do.
That's right. There are
those who are able to rise to the standard, but they would be able to do that whether the standards were set at that height or
right.
not.
Right.
And so maybe what we should be thinking about instead are more individually based curricula and individually based models for teaching
mm-hmm.
kids, so that this student who can handle a little bit more work, let's give them a little bit more, but these other students who maybe can't handle that,
mm-hmm.
let's keep the expectations at a more developmentally appropriate level for them.
With the caveat that even if your child
But
is
all in the same classroom.
Right. Because even if your child is ahead of schedule, how, you know, if your child completes all the high school requirements by age 14 or 15, do you want that child to go off to college at 14 or 15?
Yeah, what is the benefit there?
Where are we racing to?
Right.
You know,
the race to nowhere.
Yeah, when do you want your child to go to college, and how would that be? You want to send a 14 or 15-year-old into a college campus?
Right.
I'm not sure that I would send my 14 or 15-year-old
right
into a college campus. So,
right. Yeah.
Yeah, where's the why are we rushing? You
right.
know, White, can't remember his first name, wrote a book, The Hurried Child,
mm-hmm.
Years ago, back in probably the 70s or 80s, called The Hurried Child. And where are we pushing these kids
yeah.
to?
Yeah. So the education system is certainly a major contributor.
That's right.
To some of these differences. But there are others as well.
Yeah, because there's an interesting statistic somewhere here.
Somewhere in your notes.
Somewhere in my notes.
You have two pages of notes.
Because when the... here it is. Since 2003, No Child Left Behind, with consequential accountability, the rates of ADHD... for lower income children
mm-hmm.
went from 10% to 15%.
Right.
Because those children were the ones who really couldn't meet the expectation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Not just behaviorally, they couldn't meet it academically. And so we said, well, why can't they? Well, they can't pay attention. And so their rates of ADHD rose. In middle and upper middle class families, the rates went from 8.1 to 8.4,
mm-hmm.
which is negligible.
Right.
Okay. So they rose for low-income children.
Mm-hmm.
They took this big leap for
right.
low-income children because we had to come up with some explanation. But it was that the expectation rose beyond their ability to achieve.
Right. And in that kind of situation, what we're really getting into is home. There are home-based factors that
yes,
contribute.
Right.
It's the type of enrichment opportunities, mm-hmm. the types of access that you have to learning enhancement and learning strategies that individuals who grow up in low-income areas just don't have access to.
The effects of poverty, the effects of mm-hmm. undernourishment, the effects of understimulation,
mm-hmm.
Under-socialized.
Right.
Children. So all these effects are also at work, and they affect the poor differentially
right.
than they
right.
affect middle and upper middle class students.
Yeah.
White privilege is the difference.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So when it comes to some of these things, so as we're getting into we're moving from the school to the home.
That's right.
We're talking about a lot of issues that some of which parents have control over.
Right.
And some of
right.
which parents don't have
mm-hmm.
control over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's naive that many people will say, well, if those parents will just give their kids some
mm-hmm.
of these, if they would just read to their child, then that would make a difference. That's true. But we have to understand, we had a podcast a couple of weeks ago about Maslow's hierarchy of
right.
needs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're struggling to put food on the table, you're not going to set sitting down reading with your child as a high priority.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have many other priorities associated with survival.
That's right.
And you're not going to be able to you know, carve out, you know, 30 minutes to sit with your child and read a couple of books.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not realistic.
That's if the parent can read.
If the parent can read.
And if the parent can read English.
Right.
Okay, so you have all these other questions that you say, well, they should just read to their kids. What if they can't read?
Right.
What if they can't read English?
Right.
Not that simple.
And should we say that simply because they can't,
mm-hmm.
or simply because they're not available to do that, does that mean that the child then has ADHD?
Right.
No,
right.
That's not ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
ADHD symptoms, factors associated with the presentation of something that looks like ADHD,
mm-hmm.
but not necessarily ADHD.
That's right. Because the other thing we talk about, I mentioned the term consequential accountability.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once schools were tasked, were pressured, were forced mm-hmm. by state law to force kids to reach this higher level, then the rates of ADHD went up.
Right.
A second reason was accommodations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that if you could, in some states, if you get a diagnosis of ADHD, your test scores aren't counted in the
right.
average.
Right.
Not in every state. In
right.
Florida, I think they are, but
right.
in some states they're not. So the incentive to make a diagnosis mm-hmm. Increases
right.
as the expectation increases, because those kids' test scores are not counted.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if they can get additional accommodations,
mm-hmm.
then that will help to raise their test scores.
Right.
But you need a diagnosis to right. get the accommodations. It's
right.
one of the things we do, is we ask for accommodations on the SAT
right.
or in college boards and college classrooms. So if you can get accommodations, you have the possibility of raising their test scores.
Right.
Okay. So there are two incentives here: consequential accountability
mm-hmm.
and accommodations.
Right.
Okay. Since 2003, in fact, I think I have the dates. 2003, that's when No Child Left Behind was in force,
right.
fully implemented, signed in 01, but implemented in 02 and 03. The rates of ADHD in 03 was 7.8%.
Mm-hmm.
By 2007, it was 9.5%.
Mm-hmm.
By 2011, it was 11%, maybe as high as 15%.
Right.
So again, the more pressure there is, the higher the rates of ADHD.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And again, that's sort of bridging back from the parent, from the home to the school. But even with that, we have issues in the home because,
that's right.
you know, well, if let's be honest that, you know, raising a child with ADHD is challenging. It requires mm-hmm. additional resources. It requires medication sometimes, many times. It requires, you know, sometimes therapy and some parent training and all those kinds of things. And so we live in a society that we seek to support those who have to raise children with some of these developmental and medical mm-hmm. conditions. And so a child with ADHD may qualify for something like disability. Well, so again, now we have some additional motivations to have children identified mm-hmm. With ADHD, even if the parent is able to generally manage mm-hmm. the child's behavior, they may seek a diagnosis of ADHD because of all of these things that we just because they need the additional financial support and assistance that they can get from that.
We're seeing that with autism spectrum disorder
right.
today. A similar thing has happened, that now autism spectrum disorder mm-hmm. is on a spectrum, mild to severe, and very often parents are advised, go ahead and make the diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
Let somebody make the diagnosis, because then you will qualify for more services.
Right.
So the rates go up.
Right.
But they're being pushed artificially.
Right.
I use the word artificially, because you get more services
right.
if you have the diagnosis.
That's
so most
point.
Parents are willing to say, okay, I'll make a deal with the devil here. I'll make the diagnosis, because that's the only way I can get the services that I need.
Right. Well, and even providers, even psychologists and physicians will say, I'm going to go ahead and make the diagnosis so you can have the services. I'm not sure
right.
if that's what it is,
right.
but let's go ahead and get them the services, because if they respond well to the services,
mm-hmm.
then, you know, then that's a very good sign.
Right.
They would prefer to do that than they
right.
would be to just sit back and wait and
mm-hmm.
not give services. So,
right. Now, we're going to talk a minute about drugs, right?
And right.
Okay, so I'm going to put that aside
okay.
for a moment. We're going to stay with parenting.
Right.
Okay. And when we talk about regional differences,
right.
that's another area where culture makes a difference.
Right.
Because in the United States, we have regional differences from state to state.
Mm-hmm.
The rates of ADHD differ from state to
right.
state.
Right. Okay?
And probably the reason is the same in homes as it is in schools.
Right.
A higher level of expectation, you see higher rates of ADHD.
Right.
The level of expectation in the South
mm-hmm.
is higher than it is in other parts of the country.
Right.
Okay. And so, not surprisingly, the rates of ADHD are higher in the South than they are anywhere else in the country.
Right. Yeah. In the South, parents tend to have, of course, this is very generally speaking, they tend to be more authoritarian.
Right.
So they
mm-hmm.
expect children's unconditional compliance, and they don't mm-hmm. they don't tolerate talking back and negotiating and some of
right.
those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, any toe out of line is seen as misbehavior, seen as disobedience,
defiance.
And so we do get an increased number of children referred for behavioral issues in the South than they do up in the Northeast,
right.
especially and out West.
And the differences are fairly substantial.
Right.
I mean, it's 2 or 3% difference in some states. ADHD, if we say nationally, the rates are about 11%. Well, they're a little bit lower mm-hmm. in California
right.
and the Northwest and parts of New England. They might be hovering at about 8 or 9%, but in the South, they're 13 to 15%.
Right.
So the South, the prevalence rates in the South are much higher
right.
than they are in other parts of the country.
Right.
It's not in the water. It's right. not in the food.
Right.
It's not in the sunlight. It's that there's a different level of expectation among parents.
Right.
My wife is from the South, and she and I'm from the North. And we have this argument regularly in our house. She is convinced that children should just obey,
right.
period. Well, that's part of her upbringing as a, mm-hmm. as a Southern, as a child who grew up in the South. That's what was expected.
Yeah.
And that's what we're seeing, because that's why we have higher rates of ADHD in the South, because the expectation of how children should mm-hmm. behave. We Northerners are all surprised when we come to the South and hear yes, ma'am, and yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
It's just stunning to us.
It's because you guys are rude.
That's what we're told.
That's right.
We thought you had it wrong in the South.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't realize that we had it wrong in the North.
That's right.
Get this right.
Get it. Get
okay.
it right.
But that's one of... The other one is children should be seen and not heard. They should do what they're told. They mm-hmm. should be obedient. If they're told to do something, they should do it without question.
Right.
That's not generalizable to the rest of the country.
Right.
You know, that's not how other parents raise their children.
Right. Yeah, so we have those regional differences here in the United States. But again, that's also a significantly different view in other countries.
That's right.
Where children have many more freedoms, and I use that word very loosely, but you know, parents let their kids go and let them mm-hmm. do things, and they do the range of expected behaviors mm-hmm. are much more broad in other
right.
countries than they are here.
That's right. And I wonder too. I always talk about my children, the way they had to go to school. I couldn't have done it.
Right.
I mean, my children went to a school that was completely different than anything I could have tolerated.
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder if that level of expectation had existed when I was in school.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you smiling?
I was just saying.
Because you were thinking horn books and one-room schoolhouses.
I was trying to stay focused, but yes, I was thinking that.
Were you really?
I was.
I did go to a one-room schoolhouse. So did my younger siblings, though. So it wasn't just me. But what if the level of expectation... What if you had gone to school with FCAT? Did you have to take...
No.
No. What if you had gone to school where you couldn't have recess and you had to do this and the curriculum had changed? You'd have had a hard time.
It would have been difficult.
That's
yeah,
right.
absolutely.
No, I would have
absolutely.
Had a terrible time.
Yeah. No.
Because had the expectation for me been the same as it was for my children...
Mm-hmm.
Somebody would have had to do something with me because I wouldn't have been able to tolerate it.
Mm-hmm.
I would have been. I'm sure yeah. I would have been diagnosed.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I think it's these cultural, regional, but cultural differences.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely.
That are driving the rates up. So, that's one whole group.
That's another right.
Parenting.
So we have parenting. We have
and educational
education.
Those expectations mm-hmm. have gone up for education, and they're regionally different
mm-hmm.
for parents.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Now add to that the third leg of this stool.
How many legs are we going to have?
We can only have three in your little house here.
Okay.
Little house on the prairie. We have three of everything.
Three of everything. I think that much of the third leg is going to be lifestyle related issues like diet and exercising. And a lot of that still goes back to the house, and so I know that you're thinking of a different third leg of the stool.
Thank you.
But
I wondered where you were going to take this.
Yeah,
I'm thinking medication.
Right, and that's because that gets into the treatment
right.
of it and those kind of things. And you mentioned about the medications a moment ago, but I think that we have to first mention that. There are significant differences in exercise rates and activity and
mm-hmm.
diet and
that's true.
Those kinds of things regionally as well as geographically,
mm-hmm.
because you know there was a where was that it was on Facebook or something the other day, they posted pictures of the school lunch in different countries.
Oh, okay.
And the school lunch in different countries. I mean, that looked like a dinner that you would get at a nice restaurant. I mean, it had very nice green vegetables, and you know, it was very fancy. Mm-hmm. And I don't, you know, of course, it's so hard to tell if what you see in those kinds of clickbait yeah. types of things, how real it is.
Right.
But you know, that doesn't change the fact that in other countries their diet is very different. You know, in other cities and things like that, people walk more. People, mm-hmm. you know,
true.
Fewer people have cars. You know, mm-hmm. when you think about, you know, in some certain areas of California and up in the Northeast, there are a lot of people who live in some of these bigger cities who don't have cars. They just walk everywhere they go,
right.
or at least walk to the bus mm-hmm. or to the train, and so their level of exercise is very different. Their level of their dietary intake is very different, mm-hmm. and so those have an impact on right. all of this as well.
Mm-hmm.
But let's talk about medication, because medication is important, because the way in which the symptoms of ADHD are treated vary considerably mm-hmm. in different areas as well.
You know, I read something, I hadn't thought about this before, but, and I don't like this whole, I shouldn't say it that way. There is a controversy about medication.
Right.
Some people are absolutely opposed to medication
correct.
Of almost any type.
Correct.
They there's just this, we shouldn't medicate anything.
Right.
Okay. We shouldn't even do immunizations.
Right.
Okay. So on one end of that continuum are people who are opposed to any kind of medication.
Right.
At the other end are hypochondriacs or
right.
people who just throw medication at every problem they have.
Okay. Right.
So we have the two ends of the spectrum. Most of us fall in the middle. But there are people who refer to big pharma,
mm-hmm.
the large pharmaceutical companies, and accuse the pharmaceutical companies of manipulating
mm-hmm.
people so that they can sell more medication.
Right. Okay.
Now, a few minutes ago, I mentioned consequential accountability with rising levels of expectation
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
in school. And once you raise those levels, the levels of ADHD go up.
Right.
The incidence of ADHD goes up. The medications we use for ADHD have been around for
a long time. 60, 70 years?
At least 70 years.
Right.
Ritalin and Dexedrine
mm-hmm.
have been used for at least 70 years.
And it's so fascinating how we even discovered
that.
Right.
It was accidental.
Yeah, because they were using, an amphetamine-based medication
right.
as a nasal decongestant.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, wow, look, when we give it to these hyperactive kids, they settle down.
Calms them down.
So
right.
you know what? Let's create a whole bunch of medicines that do that.
Right. Which doesn't make the medications evil, ineffective,
right.
wrong, bad, unethical.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Many of the medications we have today were discovered accidentally.
Right.
X-rays were discovered accidentally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they left some radium in a drawer, in a dark drawer, and they suddenly realized it would produce light, you know.
You know. I mean,
it was accidental. So even X-rays were accidental.
I've left radium in my desk drawer before.
That's why you glow in the dark.
Yeah, you know.
Oh, okay.
It's amazing what used to happen. Back in your day, it's amazing what used to happen.
That's right.
What people would just leave around.
That's right. Back in my day, Coca-Cola was still...
It was still based upon its name.
It was the real thing. That was the real thing. When the insurance companies... No, and this is a fascinating correlation. When the FDA approved stimulants
mm-hmm.
for ADHD, once they were approved, then private and public insurers being Medicaid,
mm-hmm.
were able to bill for it,
right.
reimburse.
Right.
Once insurance companies could reimburse, the use of the medications will
right.
rise. The incentive
right. sure.
was FDA approval.
Right.
Okay. Because if nobody pays for the medications, the rates are going to stay very low because
right.
most people can't afford them.
Right.
But once insurance... So today it would be like, if I could get a full body MRI every 3 months, I'd get a full body MRI if somebody else was paying for it.
Right.
If my insurance company would pay for it, I would get a full body scan a couple times a year.
Yeah.
Okay. Or I'd have lab tests done a couple times a year.
Why not?
But because it's expensive, we don't do it. Mm-hmm. But if the insurers are reimbursing for it, mm-hmm. then you're more likely to use it.
Right.
Okay. That's one of the problems with healthcare.
Right.
Political parties are trying to solve, because if somebody else is paying for it, you're more likely to use it.
Right.
So the use of medication rose as insurance companies reimbursed for it.
And I think it's important just to throw in our soapbox just very quickly,
right.
that's also why a lot of the natural remedies for some of these things are not emphasized,
right.
and they're downplayed by the medical community at large,
right.
because you know if pharmaceutical companies can create medications that treat this, but you can have a diet that does the same thing. We talked about the diet for that treats depression a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
There are very few physicians who are going to say, "Well, do the diet."
Right.
You know.
Right.
Instead, it's going to everything. Pushes them or leads them to medication because that's their training and that's what you know the research says, because again there's very few research studies that look at the benefits of diet and vitamins and supplements and things like that. You know, it was a big deal a number of years ago when a medication came out, and I don't remember the name, but it was basically a prescription strength omega-3
mm-hmm.
that came out for cholesterol, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big deal because it's omega-3. I mean, you can get omega-3 from anywhere. And they were saying that this was pretty remarkable, because what happened was all of a sudden now a pharmaceutical company figured out how they could make money off of a vitamin, basically, or a supplement.
Right.
And they're still not doing the research that they should be doing on some of these nutrients. But they're moving in that direction, but it's all driven by what the pharmaceutical companies can bill for and charge for and
That's
make
right.
money from.
And you take, you mentioned the dietary approach, mm-hmm. you know, the food intake or food plan. If a physician prescribes that, then is the physician responsible for monitoring it?
Right.
And they can't do it. They can't monitor
mm-hmm.
what goes on. They can monitor whether a person's taking a pill or not.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
that you can monitor. But so it's part of their training.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is what I use. I'm a trained physician. It's what I use to treat this disorder. If I'm a physical therapist, if I'm a chiropractor, if I'm a nutritionist, if I'm a dietitian, I'll use my training to develop my interventions. So this happens to be the kind of training that physicians get.
Right.
So if you take your child to a physician, they're going to use their training background and experience to make that decision regarding intervention.
Right. And not to mention that everything that they read, which they read journals
literature.
And they read their literature,
mm-hmm.
all you know supports what they're taught, what they've been trained with,
and the medication does work in about 70% of
mm-hmm.
cases.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a pretty good success rate. I mean, that's not too bad.
Right.
Okay, there's 30% non-responders. We all acknowledge that, but 70% hit rate is not too bad.
Yeah, and I think that in their approach. It is reinforced by our general desire for the easy path.
That's right.
It is much,
not
much...
Not necessarily their desire.
Right.
It's parents and teachers.
Right. Because as you said, you know, okay, so if I tell you, eat this diet, and that's going to resolve your issues, I can't monitor that, and so it's going to be dependent upon you to comply with that.
And it's going
and
to take a while.
Many of us don't want to do that.
It's going to take a while
mm-hmm.
for this diet, whatever kind of weight loss diet, depression diet, ADHD, it's going to take a while for it to work.
Right.
Medication
or
works in 30 minutes.
I can write this prescription, and it's going to cost you $10, and all you got to do is remember to take it, you know, once every morning,
and
it's
works.
Going to resolve those symptoms.
Yeah, it works in 30 minutes.
Yeah.
You know,
So we want that quick and easy remedy.
That's right.
And that's also that inability to delay gratification
mm-hmm.
is what's contributing to a lot of these issues as well. Because,
that's right.
you know, what happens when we see kids that are impatient and they can't... you know, they can't inhibit impulses and, mm-hmm. and those kind of things. We call those kids ADHD.
Right. And a teacher, good teachers, have enough behavior management skills that they could succeed eventually
right.
using behavioral approaches, but it's going to take most of an academic year.
Right. And they can't do that
they
with
don't
the
have
restrictions
that
they have.
That's right. Because of the accountability
right.
issue, they don't have a whole year to do that kind
just
of intervention.
Just a big circle. Just
that's right.
everything.
That's right. So it's nobody's fault. It's,
right.
I mean, you know, we shouldn't point the finger of blame. That's what I don't like about people who say, well, it's Big Pharma that's the problem.
Right.
No, Big Pharma's a piece, but so are state legislators who
right.
who have artificially raised lower
right.
the curriculum.
Right.
You know? So we're all contributing to this.
Right.
Parental demand. I want to change right now. I need
right.
immediate relief.
Yeah.
So we're all part of this.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
But this whole drug thing is fascinating because the incentive is there.
Yeah.
I don't know. But it works. It works yeah. in 70% of kids. Are they dangerous drugs? If misused, they are. Are they?
Yeah.
Could they be addictive? Yes, if they're misused. But so can a lot of other things be addictive if they're misused.
Right. Yeah, I think it's difficult when we think to talk about some of those issues with the medications because.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're right. Sometimes, yes. I mean, there are times when it can be abused. There are times
right.
when it's
mm-hmm.
When there's side effects that mm-hmm. we want to avoid that we just can't tolerate.
Right.
There are those who don't want to be quote unquote dependent mm-hmm. on a medication
right.
to be able to manage these things. And mm-hmm. so there are some issues associated with the medications. But are they safe? Generally speaking,
generally
for the majority
safe.
Of people, yes. I mean,
yeah. I mean, kids have been taking these medications. I mean, people have been taking these since at least 1938.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, Ritalin by itself has been around for so long
right.
that if we have plenty of long-term studies and
right.
long-term observations mm-hmm. of patients to say, okay,
right.
it's all right in the majority of
right.
cases. Are there those that don't respond well that have problems? Absolutely.
But I think in our case, we have made it our business, and part of it is our, you know, both of us worked in medical schools and hospitals, and so we have this perspective.
Mm-hmm.
We know about medications and what they do and their mechanisms
right.
of action and the pharmacokinetics of these various medications, so we understand that part. But to us, the medication is simply one of the approaches that
right.
we use. And you and I think, especially over the past couple of years,
mm-hmm.
have begun moving in those other directions.
Right.
There was a time when it was, well, you use medication and behavior management.
Right.
Okay,
right.
That's fine. But now there's a whole third
yeah.
rail, third what are they called? Legs. What do you call them? Stool. Three-legged stool. Don't you call it a three-legged stool?
I'm just listening.
You're letting me dangle out here
mm-hmm.
by myself?
Yes, it's the third-legged
stool.
I'm going
to get even.
Yeah.
You know. So I'll wait for an opportunity.
The
third leg of the stool
yeah.
is all these other life, what
right.
do you call them, lifestyle,
yeah.
Nutrition,
yeah.
exercise, sleep, omega-3s, all the supplements. So I think there's a rich
right.
Leg here that we haven't taken advantage
right.
of. That we fortunately are beginning to in our practice. So
right.
yes, medication has a role to play. Yes, behavior management has a role to play. But there is this third leg.
Right.
And we have underutilized that forever.
Right.
And it's time that I think we start using those approaches because they are effective.
Mm-hmm.
They are going to work.
Right. Well, and let's be honest that the reason that we have really moved that direction in our practice is because of the expectations of the parents.
That's right.
You know,
mm-hmm.
as more and more parents of children mm-hmm. with these behaviors say, I want something different.
Right.
I want to know different ways to help
my child.
Is there
anything else I can do?
Right. So I can mm-hmm. avoid medication. I can avoid
right.
that route.
Right.
You know, what else can I do? You know, that pulls us in that direction.
Right.
And so for those of you with children with ADHD, if you want a different approach, if you want to manage those symptoms in a different way,
mm-hmm.
that's the conversation you should be having. It's going to be difficult to have that conversation with most physicians, not all, but most physicians. It's going to be a difficult conversation because
right.
most of them are very allopathic and they're going mm-hmm. to, you know, okay, there's the symptoms, here's the medication, and
right.
they're going to approach it that direction. So you may need to go to others. I'm trying to avoid the word alternative medication or alternative medical providers, just because we tend to think of that in with a little bit more of a negative connotation. But it is an alternative perspective. It is an alternative, you know, strategy for managing the symptoms.
Alternative in the sense of other. Here's another that you can use. It's no less useful.
Right.
It's no less valuable.
Right.
So we don't mean to reduce its value.
Right.
Or effectiveness.
Right. Absolutely. Right. So the more that parents and kids push in that direction, the more people are going to go in that direction.
That's
more
right.
professionals are going to move in that direction.
That's right. And as you know, people have this expectation of is there something else?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there are other things that are effective and that are useful, and not only effective, but they're also safe.
Absolutely.
You know, and probably useful. I mean, we all should be taking omega-3s anyway. We all should be sleeping better.
Well, I was going to say, in the very least, a healthier lifestyle is going to be healthier for you.
In general.
In the very least.
Right.
So,
so
if it doesn't, even if it doesn't help with all the ADHD symptoms, it's going to make you feel better, and it's going to, you know, hopefully give you a longer life and more productive.
Yeah, people say, well, you know, sugar's bad for your teeth. Well, sugar's bad for everything. So, you know, save your teeth, but save your whole body, because it's bad for all of your body systems. So
absolutely.
These are good for all of us. They're good things to follow for all of us. So, yes, let's use that third leg.
Yep, absolutely. So
fun, tough. This is interesting stuff.
This was a long podcast.
I know, but maybe apologize for that. Especially for our listeners with ADHD, because they'll have a hard time. Put it in listen to it in the car or something.
Yeah. We could figure out how to put some animations in there just to keep it interesting enough for
people like us who have a hard time paying attention.
Yeah, absolutely.
How long has it been?
It's been almost an hour.
Oh, that's so.
Not too bad.
All right.
Our typical Saturday.
Well, we're energized, though, today, because it's approaching the end of the week.
And yes, it is. So that's good. It's good stuff.
Now, this is really, you know, you and I have said many times, I've been dealing with ADHD for a long time.
Since it was hyperkinetic or minimal brain dysfunction?
When was it then? Let's see. No, it was minimal brain dysfunction.
It would have been minimal
brain. It was before ADD?
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Because I wrote down, this changed in 1980 is when this changed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's when DSM-3 came out.
Right,
and I forget her name, Virginia, from Canada, said, you know, we really should distinguish between ADD hyperactivity, ADD without hyperactivity, and that was that first distinction that was made. And it was right after that we made ADHD a neurological disorder.
Right.
Whereas France considers it a sociological disorder.
Mm-hmm,
it's about parenting and child rearing.
Yeah.
And French parents raise children differently than America. Right. French parents today raise children the way we were raised.
Yeah.
Regular meal times, regular bedtimes, you know, highly structured.
Mm-hmm.
But this became a neurological disorder in 1980.
Yeah.
And I saw my first kid with ADHD before then.
Yeah.
So we have been dealing with, we've been dealing with this for a long time. And you think the last word, because thousands of articles and thousands of research studies have been done on this topic, and yet things keep changing.
Right.
So we've said this many times, that you think the last word has been said on ADHD, but it hasn't.
Yeah.
And so there's a whole new line of research and clinical effort with this third leg of lifestyle choices and decisions that we now need to pursue.
Yeah.
So the last word on ADHD has not been written, and there's much more to talk about. So I'm glad we could have this discussion today.
Yeah, absolutely. So, all right.
Yes.
Well, that's it for today. So we appreciate you guys sticking with us and getting through all of this, because it is important and it's relevant.
And if you want to talk about these alternatives, these other approaches, because it's something we do routinely now, that we say to parents, you know, medication is an option, but we have to do these other things anyway.
Right. Yeah.
So let's start with these, and then if we need medication, we can always use it. You know, it's always available. So We're doing this here, so if you have questions, give us a call.
Absolutely.
And if you have
write to us
experiences with this with your own children, please let us know if you have questions. If we can help out in any way.
Right. And if you find our podcast helpful or informative, you know, we would love for you to jump on to iTunes or even YouTube and you know, give us a thumbs up, give us a rating. You know, just let us know so that other people, you know, when you rate us, it helps increase awareness, because then other people can find us a little bit more easily, and we can get the word out there and get more people involved in talking about it. So, all right.
Very good.
Well, so that's it for today. Thanks again, and we will see you next week. So until then, I'm Dr. Bernie.
I'm Dr. Richard.
Stay happy, stay healthy, and forget to be afraid.